You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and unfortunately, my co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, is taking a vacation, so we won't have her today, but I know that she will be with us in spirit. And the holiday I'm talking about is Martin Luther King's birthday. And I'd like to touch on something in regards to that, and that is that I think that what he achieved by getting a nation to be able to rewire its brain collectively proves the point of our guest that we can all rewire our brains in love. And I want yes, we can. And I want everybody out there to know that each week we're going to continue to bring guests like this that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. And we're going to address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we're going to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, today, we're going to be talking about how to rev up your relationship by rewiring your brain. Now, I think most of us would agree, falling in love and being loved in return is the peak experience of our existence. But the question is, what happens when one or both parties falls out of love? Now, to answer that question and much more is our guest today, Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver. Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver is a nationally known...
Fran is okay.
Yeah, Dr. Fran. Okay. She is a nationally known clinical psychologist and relation psychoanalyst. She is the author of Daring Wives, which is insight into women's desires for extramarital affairs, and Crossroads at Midlife, which is your aging parents, your emotions, and yourself. And the subject of our show today... The book is The New Science of Love, How Understanding Your Brain's Wiring Can Help Rekindle Your Relationship. Dr. Praver has been in private practice in Long Island, New York since 1996, specializing in the field of intimate relationships, trauma, unconscious processes, and neuroscience. She has helped numerous couples bring love back into their lives by helping them make lasting changes in their unconscious minds, deep in the neural pathways of their brain. Dr. Praver, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I got to tell you,
about Martin Luther King and how he created social change by using a collective kind of brain. And here we're talking about change in your love lives, but it's also a change.
Absolutely.
And it also happens in your brain.
That's right. It's happening in your brain, and it really does come down to all being about love. So as someone who has been reading your book over the last week, I'm very, very interested. But I think the first question that really comes to mind is that at what point did you realize that this was something that we could go in and change for the better and change permanently?
Well, you know, when I work with people and they come into my practice, and they are really very disturbed because there was a time when people came to a psychoanalyst simply to grow and to know themselves. But now I find people come when they're in trouble. And couples would come in and love had disappeared. And it was kind of wonderful to see how they can really change. And a lot of people don't think they can. And they want the other person to change. But... and so I began to investigate what is really going on. I've always been interested in the brain and what goes on internally with our unconscious processes. As a matter of fact, Freud was a neurologist. The only problem was back then he didn't have the medical breakthroughs and the science that we have now to be able to prove his or provide evidence for his theories. But he was a neuroscientist, and he wrote about libido, which was love, and sex, that was his big thing, and aggression. But there's more to it than that. There's attachment, and there's bonding. And that's a very different thing than just sex and aggression.
So then okay, so why then is science specifically so important in love?
Well, you know, you think about what is the most erogenous zone in the body. And if you think it's the genitalia, no, you're wrong, it's the brain. So when two people fall in love, the brain goes into action. And the feelings you get all over your body, that's because the brain triggers the release of love-inducing brain chemicals. And some of these are called oxytocin, not oxycontin, oxytocin, and vasopressin. And these are the ones that when a mother is nursing a baby, they promote trust, attachment, bonding, and love. And they are also, secreted in us when we fall in love. And then there's dopamine. And that's, you know, what that's all about. That's what drug addicts look for, is to get a high from dopamine. But you can actually get that from falling in love, along with testosterone, which is the sexual hormone, and natural opiates. And they promote feelings of love, lust, and erotic pleasure. And then we have mood-enhancing neurotransmitters like serotonin and GABA, and they are triggered. And so we're really up on cloud nine. And what? Okay, sorry.
Oh no, I was just going to say that as you were saying that, I was thinking that, you know, if we can get more people high on love, then we're probably going to get fewer people high on drugs.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, I agree.
So tell me, is love really blind?
Well, this is a very fascinating discovery of neuroscience. It says that the saying love is blind has neuronal underpinnings. So when you're caught up in the euphoria of love, our brains get busy engineering a remarkable feat. They put the brain systems that trigger suspicion to sleep. These are the very faculties our prehistoric ancestors developed in order to anticipate a predator. Wariness, doubt, skepticism, discrimination, and judgment, they all go to sleep. They go dormant on us when we're in love. And as a result, that we have all these good mood, you know, love-inducing chemicals going on at the same time, so it's kind of a double whammy. You have no suspicions and no discrimination, and you're not judgmental of somebody you're in love with. At the same time, you have all these love-inducing chemicals going for you. And so all you see is a flawless lover in the untroubled future ahead of us.
Well, now, how does that work then when you have people that are in love and things seem to be going really well, and then mm-hmm. one starts to become incredibly suspicious? You know, they all of a sudden there's, you know, there's that concern
well,
about infidelity.
Well, these blinders, you know, fall away. And, you know, when you and then there's something else I want to talk about, is that when two people fall in love, you know, you think about soulmates, mm-hmm. there's a deep connectedness, and that connectedness is explained by mirror neurons. And this is kind of the feature in this book, and this is the newest, most exciting discovery of neuroscience. And this was discovered in Parma, Italy, by some neuroscientists, and they were working with monkeys. And these mirror neurons are minuscule brain cells located behind the eye socket. And they connect intimate partners at an internal level. And in the experiment, it was the monkey and the experimenter. And so ordinarily, when neurons fire, it's because you're doing something. But in this case, the neurons of the monkey fired when the experimenter or the researcher was doing something. And so, and then you would think it was because he saw him, but it was not quite that, because another experiment, they put an opaque screen in front of the monkey, and he couldn't see what the experimenter was going to do, and he could anticipate it. It's almost like at an internal level they were connected. And so we extrapolate that to the love condition. And these brain cells connect intimate partners, as I said, at an internal level, and each partner mirrors with these little mirror neurons, the other partner's actions and feelings of attraction, romance, love, lust, good moods, erotic desire, good memories and intentions, and all of those brain chemicals. Unfortunately, when you begin to hurt each other, things change. And that's because hurtful interactions tend to get repeated. It's a strange thing, but we repeat them in one way or another. But it's almost like the same cloth with another wrinkle. And they're repeated. And before you know it, love goes awry. And there's disappointments and hurts and anger and depression. And people blame each other. They attack each other, defend each other. All of those terrible interactions get stamped into the brain. And you know those mirror neurons that were reflecting both before that, these really positive feelings?
Mm-hmm.
Now they're reflecting negative feelings to each other. And instead of recruiting happy moods, they're recruiting sad moods and bad memories. And everything that they place love and lust and empathy were on hold. And empathy is really very important in love. And when there's hurt and disappointment, empathy gets blunted.
Right, but
what you can change all of that.
That's what I was going to say. I was just going to say, but what you're saying is that in the same way in which that can go, it kind of go negative, we have mm-hmm. the ability to change the brain back to going positive. How do we do that?
And this always amazes me when I see it, the spirit of the human condition. It's really amazing. Yes, brains can change, and that's because the brain is plastic. That means it can shape and reshape, form and reform. And you know those emotional memories that get, you know, dug into your brain? Well, the amygdala, that's the seat that's in the brain, a little pea-sized organ in the brain. And in that, the amygdala is the seat of emotion. It's a fight or flight response to trauma. And the amygdala, we have found, is also plastic. So, and that's the seat of emotion. So that can change too. It's not just you can change the memory when you think about it, but you can feel differently about it. So minds can change. And emotions can change, and brains can heal, and relationships can be repaired. So we have to change patterns of relating, and then we can create changes in our neural pathways. And the good part of it is, if you are listening and you're one partner, you are one person in a partnership, if you create change, because your partner is linked to you with mirror neurons, your partner can't help but change in some way too. Now, I'm not saying this is a panacea, but that partner will change in some way, too, and I see it all the time. And if you do it, I would say begin to see your problems early, because if it digs in very long, it's awfully hard to change.
Now, why is this not easy? Why is this something that then is difficult? Because obviously there's so many people out there struggling with it.
Yeah, it's difficult because we say old habits die hard. And that's because these painful emotional scenarios that I talked about, they dig into our brain and they impair change. It's like dug in so deep. And I have patients right now. I have a couple, and he was an alcoholic. I guess he is an alcoholic. And he was neglectful of her and went out drinking and playing with his friends. And she did everything in the house, and as well as the children, and worked, and love eroded. And she was in terrible pain. And now he's decided to change all of that. But it's very difficult for her because that emotional pain is dug so deep into her brain. She can't just sort of give it all up and go forward and trust that it'll go forward. So it takes time. It really takes time. But the good part, like I said before, is the amygdala, the emotional part of the brain, is also plastic. So that can change, and we can change our emotions. We need to learn the tools to unlock the brain from these painful interactions.
Well, what are some of the tools that we can use to unlock the brain?
Okay. One of them is, I call it, visit the past but live in the future. And by that, I'm talking about knowing yourself. You know, very often you might react to your partner in a very inappropriate way. You overreact. And when you're doing that, possibly it's something from the past that is encroaching on your relationship in the present. So that, let's just say, your partner was busy that evening, he was inattentive for a moment, and boom, you're at him. But possibly you had a very depressed mother who was inattentive and couldn't give you what you needed. and you were angry. And so you might be reacting to that past trauma that has never been healed and dumping it on your partner. It's amazing, though, how we tend to say we marry our mother or our father, or we coerce them into being like them. And it's not really that. It's just that that sticks in our brain, the old trauma. So it's almost you have to go back a little, understand your childhood, understand the scripts you wrote back then, and try to rewrite new scripts. And you can do that because the brain is plastic.
Right. And what I hear you saying is that you don't have to necessarily relive the past, but you can certainly learn from it.
Well, you want to relive it long enough to be able to, I would say not live in it, but relive it, just enough to feel the emotion of the past, to feel the intensity. So when you go back, I give you exercises to go back into your past, like to check the old environment and think of snapshot memories that will come to life. And your memory has to come back with an intense emotional feeling, not just, you know, like something on a TV, but you have to feel it. Or to remember your parents, your sibling relationships, the scripts you wrote. But once you do, you don't want to stay there. You don't want to keep going over the past. You know, go over it once, understand what it is doing to you in the present, and see your partner for who he or she really is, and not as a figure from the past. So we tend to be haunted by old ghosts. As I say, you have to transform those ghosts into ancestors that you can live with.
That sounds good.
It's interesting because, yeah, the neural pathways of an infant are laid down in infancy. Of an adult is laid down in infancy between the mother and child. So if the mother was, as I said, distracted or in her own head or preoccupied or depressed, the infant learns a certain repertoire of behaviors. Either the infant withdraws and tries to comfort herself or himself, and that goes on in later life too. And or the infant might have tried to get the mother's attention and pursue her in every which way, which you'll find people in adulthood do. I see this going on in my practice right now when they can't have what they want. They can't walk away. They just push it and push it and push it, and they push the other person away, of course. And there are different scenarios, you're right. You could say, well, how could I know what was in infancy? But you can see it in your adulthood. You could see it with your friends in childhood. And so when you see that, you could say to yourself, is that really going on now, or is this an old ghost? And I have to transform that into something that I can live with in a different way.
Now, in many cases, can some of the people who feel this going on at a younger age, I mean, go back and talk with their parents and see maybe what they went through to maybe help them walk through it and get it into their true past?
Well, I say that again.
Well,
if as a child.
Yeah. In other words, what you're saying is that a lot of these things were handed down, you know, in infancy. You know, but now.
That's right.
Yeah. So now, when you have a teenager or someone say that's going through some issues.
Exactly. You're right on. So in adolescence or even in childhood, you can catch it right there because I work with children and adolescents. And the reaction to their parents is so severe at that time. And once you can help them then, yes, that will certainly augur well for adult life. But not everybody is in therapy as children or adolescents, but I agree with you.
Okay.
You can.
Great.
You can prevent a lot.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of
the
other
thing
tools?
I'm sorry.
No, go right ahead.
Okay, the second tool I talk about is to savor your strengths and face your frailties. And this book was originally written for women, but I think the same thing is all true for men. But you really have to love, when they say love yourself, how do you love yourself? You have to savor your strengths. A lot of women, we have been faced with a lot of negative societal messages, like you have to, if you're really autonomous and you're independent and you're a powerful businesswoman or a professional, you're somehow rather not feminine. I remember that said a lot about Hillary Clinton. I happen to think she's very feminine, but a lot of men don't think so. And women growing up, and I see even young women women in college, women in high school, girls still, they're still somehow or other not savoring their strength. It's almost they have to dumb themselves down to be with a boy. And so society has given us these messages. And I talk about how to savor your strength. And if you're a powerful woman, why not? There's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. And if you're faced with these messages, I really show you exactly how to rewrite them. So,
Give us an example. Yeah, please do.
I will. I will. Of course. I certainly will. Let me give an example. Okay, I'm going to give you, so there's two kinds of messages. There's that we incorporate as women, societal messages. And, you know, many negative ones in our society can erode a solid foundation of self-esteem. For example, a woman might feel old and unappealing when she sees these young, hot-looking, anorexic, Pierce models like Salinger, I think her name is. That's the new hot model. And they have smooth skin and long, shiny hair. You know, and what I say is reframe how you look at the situation. Tell yourself that although you're probably twice her age, you also have twice her life experience,
mm-hmm.
twice her know-how, insight, and sensitivity. And then I also think you have to accept your limitations and create new vistas based on your strengths. For example, accept that your once smooth face is showing some signs of wrinkling. Remind yourself that these signs of aging add to the charm of a savvy, sexy woman.
Mm-hmm.
So not mm-hmm. everything is 22-year-olds. I don't know if you have a lot of 22-year-olds listening, but I'm really writing about women a little more than 22. And savor the strength of age, is knowing that you have survived life stressors and have grown more resilient to be able to face these new challenges. So think about what you've gone through. And at this point, think about your needs and desires. And maybe you want more leisure time, creative activity, spiritual awareness, or a more passionate love life. And recognize your accomplishments at home or at work. No matter which, embrace the effort that you put into your achievements. For example, at home, you may know just how to support your family members without dictating or neglecting their needs. And at work, you may have just picked the right amount to ask for a raise. So the right moment, so you can value yourself as a woman. I'm talking to women right now, whether you're at home or whether you're at work. And then I talk a lot about damaging childhood messages, mm-hmm. and that's a big problem. That really impairs our self-esteem. For example, if your parents didn't recognize or validate your real strengths, and they had other expectations. And when you reflect on the script you wrote back then, you hear your parents' critical, punitive, and demoralizing voices. And I'm telling you to counter those voices and replace them with ones for approval. Rewrite the message, I'm not good enough, to it was a difficult situation and I did the best I could do at the time. And if you didn't meet your family's expectations, you made mistakes along the way, you know? And you rebelled. And I'm going to tell you, because I'm one of these people, cherish the freedom you gained by living authentically. If you took risks or fell on your face a few times, too many, you no doubt gained valuable experience from those adventures, and you've grown stronger as a result. Take heart in knowing that plunging right into life and love is much more fulfilling than living life on the fringes. Look at the bright side. The upside of taking risks is that at the end of the day, you'll not bemoan any lost opportunities. Then, of course, you might have complied with your family's expectations, and that way you lost your true self. And we really want to find our true selves. You now experience your life as constrained and meaningless, and you feel that you're a prisoner to other people's expectations. And here are some of the resolutions. I say now is the time to free yourself and begin the journey of life your way. The battle for a freer, more meaningful life is not an easy one, But when you finally win, you can't help but cherish your strengths. Imagine what you can engage in now that you formerly thought was too risky, and then do it. If you always wanted to play an instrument, sing or dance, or wear a very sexy negligee to your partner when he comes home, but you never took these because you were afraid of not being good enough or insecure, then go for it. I'd say go for it right now. Challenge your inhibitions. And if you want to dance, follow the music and movement. And you can get into the groove at the gym and a lot of different places. Let's say you feel self-conscious. I know so many people who would like to lose weight. They'll try to diet, but they won't go into a gym because they feel self-conscious. They don't look as good as the other women. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah.
And free yourself from the chains of self-consciousness. At this point in your life, you should feel free to do things your way and have fun doing them. The only way you will know if you like something is to try it. That way you'll have greater autonomy and independence. And that's going to create new patterns in your brain. And so that you will reflect a more adventurous, exciting, stimulated, invigorated person to your partner. And with mirror neurons, he can't help but be fascinated by you. So it has a double effect. When you begin to really value yourself and go for it, not only do you become more invigorated, but your partner does too. And there's many, many more other ways that I can go into in the book, but we don't have all that time.
I appreciate that very much, and I agree. And I love the part about mirroring, the fact that you know, we're going to mirror these things back and forth. And as long as you keep mirroring that, you're both going to grow from it. So I think that's great. Now, we're going to take a break. We are talking with Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And you're back with Answers for the Family. We are talking with Dr. Fran Cohen-Praver, and the book is The New Science of Love, How Understanding Your Brain's Wiring Can Help Rekindle Your Relationship. Now, Dr. Praver, one of the things I read a little bit about in your book, and I wanted to address a little bit more, are what are some of the ways in which the past affects our current relationship? Because I think so many of us, we carry a certain amount of baggage and we bring it to the next relationship. How can we stop that cycle?
I think you have to know, as I said before, you have to understand what is happening. And I take you by the hand in this book, and I take you back to your past. And I have you go back into the old environment, go back into your childhood relationships, into your parental relationships, and try to think of how you interacted with your parents. Were you a compliant child? What did you give up? Were you a rebellious child? What happened then? And are you in some way coercing your partner into the same old behavior so you can interact in that old familiar way? It's amazing, but you know, the word familiar, well, that stems from the word family. That's the root word is family. So what is familiar and we seem to be comfortable with even though it's very uncomfortable, is what happened in the family. And in my book, I give you an example of a young woman, she was married, and she had a very overprotective, very disciplined father. And she married this man, Nino, and before you knew it, she was off, you know, getting into accidents and calling him, not finding her way home and calling him. And he began to interact with her just as her father did, as being overprotective and very disciplined to her, because she really seemed to be lost without him. And so she coerced her partner into becoming the same thing as her father. She said she married her father, so she had to become more autonomous, more independent, and see what she was doing to recreate her past rather than live in the present and understand the past.
Well, but now if she starts making all of those changes and she becomes a different person, how does that then affect him and the changes in his brain if he set out to marry someone that he could take care of in that manner?
It's quite amazing, though, because she's going to become a very independent, strong woman. And, you know, it's amazing because he will change, too. And he might find that he has more time to himself. He has to have more time to himself to grow within himself. So he's living with a rescue fantasy. He's always got to rescue her. And so he's got to begin rescuing himself. He needs work, too, if this is the interaction. Both people need work. And so he has to begin to find himself and other activities that fulfill him rather than rescuing her constantly. Because every damsel in distress has a man who has a rescue fantasy.
Right.
So when one person changes, he'll be off balance, exactly, and he has to create some change within him.
Right. So it's a teamwork situation. They have to be able to, as they make this change, do it from a teamwork standpoint and support each other, knowing that there's going to be changes in the other, and they may feel a little uncomfortable when they're out of their comfort zone.
Exactly. I write about that in the book. It takes a while, because suddenly this woman becomes stronger, more independent, more autonomous, and this is not exactly what he bargained for, but as he begins to find himself in a different way, he doesn't need that from her anymore. So both people are stronger. You know, two halves don't really make a whole in a relationship. You need two wholesome people who can interact and become interdependent.
I love that.
And I really think you both have to be, you know, you can't have two half people. It's amazing. It does not make a whole.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Now, you have a section in the book where you talk about how you forgive infidelity. I know a lot of people have to deal with that. Share a little bit on that, please.
That's a tough one. That's a very tough one, you know. I'm going to use the woman in this case, but this is just for argument's sake. For discussion purposes. So if your spouse has strayed, you're probably feeling you're not good enough, you weren't gorgeous enough, sexy enough, enticing enough, exciting enough, and you're feeling your self-esteem has plummeted to the toilet. You're feeling despair, angry. And that's because there's a trauma of infidelity, and that trauma lodges into your brain. And like I said, for discussion purposes, I'm going to use she as the one who wants to forgive, like the man cheated, but could be the other way around. Many women I see, they obsess about the affair, and they ply their partner with numerous questions in order to make sense of it, maybe to punish him. So they'll ask him, this goes on and on. You can't believe how long this can go on. And she'll ask him, when did they do it? What did she smell like? What did she wear? What was she looking like? You can't imagine, and what did you feel, and where was it, and how was it? And this goes on and on. No matter how much he responds, she can't let go of it. And unfortunately, the longer she does this, the more she stamps the trauma into her brain and the harder it is for her to heal. And the other part is, really, the more you punish your partner, he doesn't have to punish himself. Because one of the biggest self-punitive measures is feelings of deep guilt. And you don't even let him get there if you keep punishing him. So women, if you are listening and your spouse is cheated, I will suggest to you, don't keep questioning him about it. And then here are some steps that I will suggest to you that I recommend. First of all, find empathy for yourself. That means have some compassion for yourself. Chances are you were good enough. You were lovely and everything else, and something went awry. And then once you have empathy for yourself and compassion for yourself, then you have to look at your partner and have empathy for him. And that's very difficult because clearly he didn't have empathy for you when he was doing it. I have all kinds of infidelity in my practice. I don't know why now I have a lot of men who, or and sometimes women, who are sexual addicts. And they actually have sex with multiple partners. It's not really about love. I don't even know if it's about lust or power. It's a compulsion. It's an addiction. It's a way of getting that dopamine going, you know, that high, just as a drug addict uses a drug. The sex addict uses sex as a fix. But the wife still is very badly hurt, and I've seen, and it's a horrible thing because very often he has so little empathy for her that he actually brings disease to her. He doesn't even think about it at the time. So that's very serious stuff, and I'm working presently with some people with this situation. How does a woman forgive that? Well, somewhere she has to get to know him well, maybe understand his childhood and what happened and why this happened. Because in the brain, there's some studies that show that empathy and forgiveness are overlapped in the brain. Mm-hmm. So if you are to forgive, you can't forgive unless you have some empathy for your partner. Chances are he's not a monster, but he is a hurt child from way back when, and something went very awry. Because I don't think drug addicts are necessarily monsters or alcoholics, but it's almost the same thing. Unless your partner fell in love with another woman. But if he's in love, let go. If he's not in love with her and he is in love with you, then listen to him. Listen to him. And let him talk. Let him explain what he feels. First, you have to explain what you feel. Be very clear about what you feel. Don't keep playing with questions. Just what you feel, how this has hurt you and how this has damaged you. And as you do it, look at your partner and listen to him. Okay, you have to feel that he really feels remorse deeply. And he feels remorse and guilt. And you can tell, you know him, and you know him well. And so if you feel he is sincere about it, he has to try to repair it. That means to make amends. And let's see how he does it. And listen to that too. And then I always speak about humility. In order to forgive somebody, you need some humility. Mm-hmm. Dig into yourself and find a place where you may have inadvertently hurt someone else. Might not have been this kind of hurt, but maybe as a child, you punched the nose of a child, of another child who might have been emotionally challenged or cognitively challenged because the kids prodded you to go and to do it. And then you felt very ashamed of yourself and very guilty because you hurt an underdog. Well, go into yourself, and you will no doubt find there was a psychoanalyst. He was an interpersonal psychoanalyst, Harry Sex Sullivan, and he said, we are more human than otherwise. And we do. We connect through humanity and try to find your humility and your humanity. And then you can go into the process of forgiveness. So it's not an easy thing, but you can do it. You can do it.
Well,
it takes a lot of listening. I just wrote a blog a little while ago for Psychology Today on listening to your partner. Do you want me to tell you about it? Because I thought it got a tremendous
Yeah, please do. Give me a little bit of information on that, and then I want to go into some of the listener questions because I think there's some that are very, 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 very good and timely as to where we're at right now.
Okay, when you think of soulmates, and you think of the deep connection that I told you about with mirror neurons, and what's amazing, I have found my patients that will say to me, I'm so in love with her. She can almost know what I'm going to say before she says it, and that's because she listens. And I write about it. It reminded me there was a Henning Menkel article called The Art of Listening, New York Times, December 11th, op-ed, page 4. And he aptly writes that we have two ears and only one mouth, so we should listen at least twice as much as we speak. But how many of us do that? I can go on and on. But that's really, really what I'm talking about is listening. Yeah. You know, in our fast-paced society with both partners working, we barely have time to talk, let alone listen to each other's stories. And I see couples in such a hurry to respond, they don't even listen to everything their partner has to say. Instead, they're in their heads planning their response. As a result, they have information but no knowledge of their partner. So whether you are madly in love with your partner right now and she's madly in love with you, you must listen. And you have to really know your partner, not just information. And people confuse information with knowledge. Knowledge means that you listen and interpret the information your partner conveys. And I can go on and on. And unlike animals, we can listen to and understand our partner's dreams, fears, joy, trauma, intentions, failures, and successes. And our partners can listen to us and understand us. And that's what humanity, intimacy, and love is all about.
That sounds great. And it sounds like that's what it takes for longevity. Now, I want to ask some listener questions. And again, I want to tell the listeners, thank you so much. I appreciate it when you email these in. This one reads, my first husband was the typical, quote, infatuation marriage. We were both young and more in love with the idea of being married than with each other. It lasted 3 years and unfortunately it left me with quite a bit of baggage about what love really is. It was many years before I would let another man into my life. My question to you is, do you think first, quote, young marriages can really be saved? Are today's young people who are even more prone to leaving at the first sign of trouble capable of hanging in there and working on their marriages?
Yes, I think they are. Is that the question?
Yes.
Yes, I think they are. And I think in this case, I'm not so sure it was the trauma of this short marriage that left you so hurt that you couldn't go on for a long time. I have a sense this trauma fell on some earlier childhood trauma of yours, because I think you would get through it faster. I don't know you, and I wish you were on the line with me and we could have a conversation. But I get that feeling, because life is taking risks. And when you're young, you take risks, you know. And think of it this way. You tried it. And I hope you do go on. And I hope you examine your childhood a little to see how that could have encroached on your relationship. So as young people, when they see things going awry, I think it's good to get into some couples therapy to examine the way you communicate with each other, to see the past and what's going on there, and learn how to communicate and how to have empathy and to be strong people so that you don't blame each other and attack and defend each other. You can do that when you're young, just as well as when you're old.
Absolutely. And which makes me want to add that if anybody is interested in trying to get a hold of Dr. Praver, or if you want to get the book, The New Science of Love, I believe that you can go to the website of www.drfranpraver.com. That is drfranpraver.com. And to, I guess, either get in touch with you or pick up the book. Is that correct?
Great.
Okay.
That's exactly right. Thank you.
All right. And then to now our next question. It says, I am a marriage counselor in Ohio with more than 60% of my practice dealing with one core issue, infidelity by one of the partners. I find that although the wrong party may be willing to forgive the other person, trust and feeling safe with that partner again is almost impossible to regain. What do you suggest I recommend to help these patients so that they can more quickly heal this very deep wound?
I think there's nothing as wonderful as new experience. So when you've had these horrible experiences, and I think that's the rub, actually. That's the rub, is the person who is the aggrievant, you know, the one who has been, not the the one who has been cheated on, that person is, as you said, very difficult for them to trust and to allow new loving experience to enter into the relationship. And that's understandable because of suspicion and because of self-protection. But life is not forever. And, you know, life is transient. And if you think in an existential manner, we don't know what tomorrow is. And so you really have to live each moment full and rich and with meaning and with love. So if your man has hurt you or your woman has hurt you and they feel remorseful, try to allow positive, new, loving experience to come into your brain and into your love life, because that and only that will replace the trauma and the hurt. There's lots of research on that. So positive, fresh, new experience can help heal. And that's the way I would do it.
That sounds great. Now, I've got one for myself, and that is, how about someone like me who is very much in love with an incredible woman? And I believe that she is very much in love with me. How do we keep love from slipping away so that we don't have to go through the steps needed to rekindle it?
First of all, congratulations to you and to her. And
thank
to
you.
All readers and listeners who are listening, I wish you all the same. It's a new year, and I wish you love. I remember Marlene Dietrich said, spoke about love a lot, and that's really what I'm saying. Whether you have loved once and you're going to love again, I think this is totally wonderful that you're saying. And I think what I talk about in the book pertains to maintaining love as well as to, you know, bringing back love. So if you're with your partner and you see yourself getting a little agitated or anxious because of something she said or vice versa to he, examine yourself and say, what's going on? Did I really just have a hard day? Am I under too much pressure? Is this something from the past that this person is pulling? And stop yourself. Think about yourself, you know? Have some insight, and that's really important. And again, I talk about independence, and I think male and female, you both have to be strong within yourself, have to have your own life that is meaning and full and rich, and only then can you become a really great partner. So I talk about equality in relationships. Make sure there's equality. I blog for, right now I'm blogging for Psychology Today, I'm also blogging for Huffington Post. And my first blog was Marital Bliss Means Equality. And that's important. You make sure you're not controlling your partner or you're not submitting, so there is an equal flow back and forth. And I talk about communication. It's very important, like I said before, to listen to your partner. We have two ears and one mouth. Let's listen twice as much as we talk. And when you listen to your partner, you can really get to know her. And you could say, I get her. And then you're in sync, and the mirror neurons can continue to flow. So you have to communicate. Also, you have to learn how to communicate in ways to get your needs met.
Well, and when
so by communicating.
I'm sorry. I'm saying, and when you talk about equality, and I'd like your opinion on my thought on this, and I don't. I don't see it as it's equality all the time, but I think if you look at things from the standpoint of you know, if I treat her like a queen and she treats me like a king, we can continue to do that. There's going to be times in which one person is going to appear to be a little bit more dominant. And as long as that works both ways, as long as there's times in which if she needs the help and I'm there for her, and then when I need the help, she's there for me. And if we have that type of equality, where to the outside person, it may appear that it's not equal at times, but I think that if one party continues along that, you then don't have equality. You have a servant. You have one that just keeps help being the helper.
Exactly. In other words, maybe the woman is a better. No, maybe the man is a better chef, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes care of the shopping and cooking, and he kind of has control of that domain. And maybe she's better at cleaning the house, for example. And so she is in control of that domain, and she'll tell him what to do, and he'll tell her what to do. And so you have your own domains of strength. And, yes, you're in control of that particular one. But that doesn't mean that the whole relationship is constantly one-sided. It
Absolutely.
Still has to be two-sided, and sometimes, just as you said, one person is more dominant, more submissive, and vice versa.
Well,
even in lovemaking, my goodness, that can change. And I'm not talking about S&M. I'm talking about normal lovemaking.
Well, that's right, and I think that's something that should also. It would be. It's great if both sides are the ones that at times are being the aggressor. And unfortunately,
absolutely.
You know, I would love to go into that part. I just glanced over, and I've been enjoying this so much, I haven't been paying attention to time. We are out of time. But again, for anybody if anybody would like to get more information, you can go to www.drfranpraver.com. If you're driving and you can't write that down, you can always go to our website. It's answers, the numeral four, thefamilyblog.com, and we will get those questions to the guest. Dr. Praver, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was too short.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great
week.
Thank
you.
Take care.
Bye
now.
You too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.